Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, Chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Limited Forum and the Chair of this program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce Kevin Stone, MD, our speaker. Kevin Stone is an orthopedic surgeon at the Stone Clinic and Chairman of the Stone Research Foundation in San Francisco. The clinic treats athletes and people with arthritis focused on knee and shoulder injuries. The foundation conducts research in advanced surgical techniques and tissue regeneration for orthopedic sports medicine. These efforts have led to improvements in cartilage replacement and regeneration, cruciate ligament repair and reconstruction, and techniques to prevent osteoarthritic degeneration. Dr. Stone has lectured around the world as an expert in cartilage and meniscal growth, replacement, and repair. He holds more than 50 U.S. patents on novel inventions to improve healthcare. Dr. Stone is the co-founder of Regen Biologics, a publicly traded medical device company focused on meniscus regeneration. He is founder of Aperion Biologics, Inc., formerly CrossCart, Inc., a venture capital-funded medical device xenotransplantation company. Aperion has developed a technique for removing the antigens from pig tissues so they may be used in humans. The first xenograft device for reconstruction of ruptured cruciate ligaments, ACLs, has received FDA approval for human clinical trials. Dr. Stone is the founder and chairman of Joint Juice, Inc., a San Francisco-based nutraceutical beverage company. Joint Juice is the first beverage with a full day's dose of glucosamine proven to reduce pain, act as an anti-inflammatory, and aid in cartilage repair without side effects. Joint Juice gained wide national distribution at Costco, Sam's Clubs, Walgreens, and Walmart after its first year of launch and is now the widest distributed supplement in America. Dr. Stone also founded Rescue Real, Inc., which received the Popular Science 10 Best Inventions of the Year 2009 award. Rescue Real is the first successful personal escape device to permit people to escape buildings up to 100 stories without Spider-Man. Dr. Stone is a physician for Smuin Ballet, San Francisco. He has served as a physician for the U.S. Ski Team, the U.S. Pro Ski Team Tour, the Honda Ski Tour, the Jeep 48 Straight Tour, the Old Blues Rugby Club, Lawrence Peck Dance Company, Marin Ballet, the Modern Pentathlon at the U.S. Olympic Festival, and for the United States Olympic Training Center. He advises ESPNW on healthcare issues for women athletes, and hosted the StoneFit Pro Women Athletes Career Conference. He was trained at Harvard in internal medicine and orthopedic surgery and at Stanford in general surgery. His fellowship was in research at the Hospital for Special Surgery and in Knee Surgery in Lake Tahoe. Dr. Stone enjoys skiing, windsurfing, surfing, and biking. He especially enjoys time with his wife and two daughters. Dr. Stone.
Thank you. It's a privilege and honor to be here. So since you're going to spend an hour thinking and hearing about knees and cartilage, I thought the best way to do that would be to look at you as if you're a patient sitting in front of me wondering about all these issues. So in order to help explain these things, I'll go through it as if you're curious about, oh, what about this and what about that, and we'll try to do that together and see where we end up. And happy to answer any questions at the end if I don't cover something fully during it. And what I'd like to do, the focus of my work and the focus of talking tonight is that biology, in my view, can usually trump bionics, meaning it's better to be biologic and natural if you can than be artificial, although clearly artificial parts, whether they be joints or arms or legs, are phenomenal inventions and help many, many people. But most of the time, we'd like to do that as the last procedure in our lifetime rather than somewhere in the middle. And so if we can develop biologic solutions to keep you active along the way, in general, that's a better solution. And so that's my bias, and you'll hear that throughout the talk. My goal is to keep you active, playing whatever sport or activity you like until the day you drop. And I'd like to have that happen at 105 for every one of you and have you go out doing something fun. So if we can keep you active, that's the goal of all of this kind of work. To put a little bit of perspective on where I think the science is going, we made a little short video, which we'll try to play and see if that works for us here. And also, since I know a number of people will be listening to this talk without being able to see the slides. I'll try to describe the slides as clearly as if you were just sitting there without having a slide. But the video is a little tricky to do that with.
We are all aware of the risk of cancer, but there's another disease that's destined to affect even more of us, arthritis. Cancer may kill you, but when you look at...
Hang on a second, because that didn't play up there.
We are all aware of the risk of cancer, but there's another disease that's destined to affect even more of us, arthritis. Cancer may kill you, but when you look at the numbers, arthritis ruins more lives. Assuming you live a long life, there's a 50% chance you'll develop arthritis. And it's not just aging that causes arthritis. Common injuries can lead to decades of pain until our joints quite literally grind to a halt. Desperate for a solution, we've turned to engineering to design artificial components to replace our worn-out body parts. But in the midst of the modern buzz around the promises of a bionic body, shouldn't we stop and ask if there's a better, more natural way? Let's consider an alternative path. What if all the replacements our bodies need already exist in nature?
So since that's not working, it shows quite well there, but it doesn't show for you when we broadcast it. So if the technician isn't around, what I think we'll do is skip that and just go on to the next slide.
We are all aware of the...
No, you're not seeing that, so let's just go to the next slide here. So let's just describe for you a little bit what happens in a knee. So the slide on your left shows a pediatric knee, and you can see the nice dark spaces in between the bones. I don't have a pointer, but if there is one here, I could use that if anyone has one. And the slide in the middle shows a normal adult knee, and you start to see the joint space starting to narrow there. And then the slide on your right shows an arthritic knee, where you see the joint space on the inside there collapsed, and that's what people call bone on bone. And you'll often hear that, oh, I have bone on bone, and what does that mean? Before you leave tonight, you're going to know exactly what that means. You're going to have your anatomy lesson. So let's take a look at what that means. So if you look at a knee joint, think about when you crack open the chicken wing, the white, shiny surface. That's articular cartilage. That's the bearing surface on top of the bone. When you get arthritis, it's wearing away of that bearing surface down to the bone. Now, also inside the joint, there's a meniscus cartilage. That's a second type of cartilage called fibrocartilage. And that's the shock absorber for the joint. And many of you may have torn your meniscus cartilage playing high school soccer or college football or whenever the surgeon went in and took out the meniscus cartilage because it was catching inside the knee. And 10, 20, or 30 years later, the two surfaces rubbing against each other wore out down to bone on bone. And that's a very common story in my practice. So most of the time, patients are coming in, and I'll show you this in a little bit, saying, hey, can't you just put a shock absorber back inside the knee? The third key important component inside the knee is the ligament, and that's that structure in the middle there. And often you hear about the anterior cruciate ligament, or the ACL. It's the key stabilizer for the knee. And again, many athletes will tear that stabilizer, and then the knee becomes unstable. And when it's unstable, it moves abnormally and then goes on to tear the meniscus cartilage, which then goes on to lead to the arthritis that we just described. So it's very important to have a stable knee with smooth surfaces and a good shock absorber. And some of you in this room are very lucky to still have all those components in place, and you are blessed. You should keep those components in place as much as you can. Other people in this room have lost one or more of those components. They either tore their ligament, they tore their meniscus, or they damaged their articular cartilage. Now, just to also put it in perspective, we're not talking tonight about inflammatory arthritis. That's rheumatoid arthritis, gouty arthritis, psoriatic arthritis. That's when the lining of the joint becomes very inflamed and attacks the cartilage, and it's a totally different system than osteoarthritis or traumatic arthritis. So tonight, we're talking about the bearing surfaces and the ligaments. So now that you're getting all expert in anatomy, you're sitting in front of me saying, hey, doc, you know, I've injured this part or that part. What does it actually look like if you looked inside my knee? And so if you look from the front, that's a front view of the meniscus cartilage there, that shock absorber. or if you look down on top of it, that's a lateral meniscus. So the shock absorber, as you look down, looks like a C-shaped device, and there's one on the outside called the lateral meniscus, and there's one on the inside called the medial meniscus. And then the articular cartilage is protected by that meniscus. You can see in the slide on your right those green structures. They almost look like doorstops. And that's what keeps the knee from sliding abnormally back and forth and also absorbs a lot of the force in the knee. And if you lose part of that meniscus cartilage, again, the articular cartilage then rubs against each other. So now you're all becoming expert in your anatomy. When you injure the knee, you tear that meniscus cartilage. Now, instead of it being a nice, smooth, cup-like shape on the articular cartilage, it gets torn. And that tear leads to catching or instability or clicking inside the knee. Or, if you smack your knee, you can damage the bearing surface, the articular cartilage. And you see in the slide on the right, instead of being white and shiny and smooth, you're starting to see the bone coming through. And that's when you put your hand on your knee and it feels grindy, and people call that crepitus. You get up from a chair and your knee kind of grinds away. Well, that's that raw surface grinding inside your knee. When it grinds inside your knee, it sprays the knee with little particles, and those little particles irritate the lining of the joint. The lining of the joint produces fluid, and then you get a swollen knee. And so, hey, doc, I twisted my knee. I heard a pop. My knee swelled. Often that you've torn the cartilage. You either got bleeding in the knee or you irritated the surface and you got knee joint swelling. Swelling and pain are bad for the knee. The most common question you might ask me is, hey, how do I know if I'm hurting my knee? And in general, swelling and pain are not good for any joint. The swelling has degradative enzymes in it that break down the articular cartilage. And if you're having pain, it's because it's not the shock absorption is not working properly, and you're further damaging that joint. So the old thinking was, well, once you've injured your cartilage, it can't heal itself because it doesn't have a good blood supply. And this is the most common thing that many physicians thought for years and many patients heard. And so the doctor would go in and say, well, there's not a good blood supply. I'll just cut away the torn tissue and see in 10 or 20 years and you'll get your new knee replacement. Well, the new thinking is opposite of that. We know that we can take those cells and put them in tissue culture and they grow very well. And so if the cell can grow in tissue culture, maybe it can grow inside the knee if you can just provide it with the right stimulus or the right nutrition or the right environment for it to grow in. So we thought, well, if it can grow in tissue culture, what do we need to do to create the healing environment inside the knee to get it to grow inside your knee, rather than just assume, hey, it's injured and we ought to take it out? And then the old thought about, you know, you've got arthritis and you've got a painful knee, and the doc would tell you, go home, rest your knee, wait until you have your knee replacement. Well, that's exactly the opposite of the advice we give to our patients today. We want you to go home and exercise. And we want you to exercise every day of the week, 7 days a week. Why? Because we want you to get addicted to all those wonderful things that exercise produces. All those endorphins, all the good blood flow, all the good pheromones, all the hormones that are stimulated by exercise. So that you feel guilty if you don't exercise every one of those days. And by exercising, you build up the muscles around the joint. It protects the joint. It absorbs a lot of the force that otherwise would go smacking through the knee. And so our job when we see you with a sore knee is to figure out how do we treat the problem, but how do we motivate you to think about yourself as an athlete in training, not a patient in rehab. And if we can do that, then we're going to optimize your muscle strength, we're going to improve your gait, we're going to get your mind in a good space, and we're going to keep you active until the day you drop. So that's the thinking. Now it's our job to figure out how to do that. So you'll say to me as my patient sitting in front of you, well, what are all the non-surgical ways you can offer me to help me with my joint? Because clearly I don't want to have surgery if I can avoid it. So let's go through all the non-surgical ways that we counsel our patients on now in order to help them improve their joints. Well, we talked about exercise, and exercise is extremely important. It's important for strength training because the stronger the muscles, the less force goes through the joint. It's important for balance training because, as you know, if you fall and break your hip and you're elderly, your lifespan is dramatically shortened. So balance is one of the key risk factors all of us have as we age, and yet it's one of the things that most of us forget to train. How often do you stand on one foot and close your eyes and see how long you can do it, or stand on a pillow or on unstable surface? We've forgotten that unless we practice that, we lose it. And if we lose it, no matter how strong we are, if we fall, we're toast if we're old, elderly and break our hip. Soft tissue mobilization. All of us get stiff as we age. That means the tissues are getting a little bit stiffer. One of the most common comments I hear from people who take glucosamine or joint juice or versions of glucosamine is, "Doc, I feel less stiff in the morning." Stiffness is a big limiter of your joint motion, and therefore you don't have the balance and gait necessary to maintain good stability. So stiffness, soft tissue mobilization, mobilizing those tissues, either with a good physical therapist or with a good massage therapist or even on your own, crucial part of exercise. Biking and pool exercises are the two things you will always be told to do if you have sore joints, and that's because it's almost impossible to hurt your joint on the bike and almost impossible to hurt your joint in the pool. And if you love to run, but you're not running these days because of a joint injury, I can get you in the pool and have you do pool running in chest-deep water. It's the flotation of the water diminishes the impact on your joint, and I can keep those good endorphins going in your head, and so there's always a way to keep you training. Stretching and proprioception. Again, the stretching part is about stiffness. Proprioception is mostly about balance, getting the neuromuscular connections to your body that we think are so important. Nutrition. So remember, we're on the stage of, "Hey, Doc, what can I do for my joints? Well, I don't want you to operate on me. How do I improve my joint health?" Well, clearly for women, my first job is to make sure that I get enough vitamin D, calcium, into their bones every day. And there are other things that are clearly important too, vitamin C, glucosamine, iron, all the things that you hear about. But most of you are vitamin D deficient. Most of you are low in calcium because most of you have been, close your ears, dermatologists, brainwashed by the dermatologists to stay out of the sun. And it turns out that only sunlight, 30 minutes a day of full body exposure, is what you need in order to convert vitamin D to vitamin D3, the active form, and really utilize the calcium that your body needs, not just for building strong bones, but for disease protection, and there's a host of diseases related to it. So if I can convince you of one thing when you come to a knee talk, is go home and please get out in the sunshine and exercise outdoors. Which reminds me about one other point about exercise. Never, ever, 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 ever read or watch TV when you're exercising. You lose 50% of the benefit of your exercise time. Why? Because remember, I'm trying to get you to think like an athlete in training. If you're an athlete in training, you're exercising, and each time you go to exercise, you're trying to improve your endurance and increase your strength. If your mind is in the TV or in the book or somewhere else, you're not feeling what's happening to your body, to your muscles, to your heart rate, to all the things you need to be thinking about. You're not receiving the benefits of those great endorphins of exercise. So please turn off the TV, exercise outdoors if you can. Don't read a book. Now, next, you're sitting in front of me saying, "Hey, look, but I'm a traveling executive. I'm on airplanes all the time. I'm in hotels. I can't manage the food intake. How do I drop my weight?" Why do I want you to drop your weight? It's because you take 2 to 3 million steps every year, normal walking, at up to 5 times your body weight, depending on the height of the step. So if you lose 10 pounds, up to 2 to 3 million times per year times 5, so 50 pounds, 2 to 3 million times per year on your joint. So how do you do it? You drink two tall, and this is not a tall glass, two tall glasses of water before you lift the fork. Why? Because it's portion control. And you can do that anywhere. If you're on an airplane, if you're an executive in a hotel, if you're at a business dinner. just down 2 tall glasses of water before you lift the fork. It will lower your caloric intake. That combined with an hour of exercise a day, you'll lose a pound a week and you'll optimize your weight. Also, because all of you are relatively dehydrated. You slept all night, breathing, no water intake. You got up in the morning, had a cup of coffee, further dehydrated yourself, probably didn't drink water during the day. And so mostly your joints function poorly when you're relatively dehydrated. One of the ways glucosamine works is by absorbing water into the tissues. It's a highly charged sugar molecule. So that water in the tissues increases hydration, increases that shock absorption. If you're dehydrated, you can't do that. So water matters very much. Next, you say, I'm going to watch my time. Next, you say, what are the other things I can do? Well, if you're walking all the time, some of the things it can do, if you're very bow-legged, we can unload the force on the inside of those joints by simply putting heel wedges in your shoes, or if you're not more knock-kneed, just doing the opposite. So there are a bunch of little tricks that we can do to improve the joint loading. Anybody with arthritis of any of the joints, the hip, the knee, the ankle, has an abnormal gait. It means you've been walking for years with a flexed knee or a tight hip. Your gait is not normal. And so when you have an abnormal gait, you're going to overload your hip or your back or some other part of your body. And, of course, you're going to develop disease or arthritis or pain in those joints. And so simple gait training is one of the really easy tools we can use to help you with your arthritic joint. We've spoken about glucosamine. I'm a big fan, as you know already. And we'll talk a little bit about nonsteroidals and hyaluronic acid as well. So glucosamine, at least 1,500 milligrams. Our patients often tell us 3,000 milligrams a day is optimal for them. It's hard to take that many pills. That's why we develop joint juice. It's easier just to down it. We really do think this increases hydration in the tissues, decreases pain, increases lubricity, and our patients seem to like it quite a bit. Not everybody responds to it, and that's true for almost everything we do in medicine. There seems to be people who are more sensitive to one intervention than others. If you're somebody who is sensitive to it, it's a very inexpensive, great way to treat your joints. We see it as a vitamin for your joint, and so our kids drink it. We think everybody can use it just like a vitamin. NSAIDs, meaning Advil, ibuprofen, all the ones that people were put on for years. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs inhibit collagen formation and inhibit bone formation. So one of the reasons why we think so many people had hip fractures and stress fractures as they aged was that through the 60s and 70s and 80s, everybody was put on non-steroidal anti-inflammatories if they were sore or aging. Well, there's very good data to show that they really do inhibit collagen formation. So our bias is to get your joint pain down with natural things like glucosamine, ice, massage, exercise, all the things that we're talking about. We'll use a nonsteroidal if we have to, and if you're having pain, they're very effective drugs. It's just we would prefer not to have you on it for any length of time. Hyaluronic acid is the normal lubricant of your joint. And many of you have heard now that when you come to the physician's office, we can inject a little bit of HA into your joint as a lubricant. Really nice, easy thing to do. Again, about 30% of the world seem to be super responders to these HA injections. Increases lubrication. It also decreases breakdown products of the joint. And so we think it's very healthy. It's almost an anabolic for the joint surface. We think it's a good idea. We do it for all of our cartilage replacement patients whenever possible. Okay, what if all of my non-operative tricks fail? Then what? Then we're going to go through what are the arthroscopic tricks that we can do? What techniques and treatments do we have arthroscopically, so an outpatient procedure that can help your damaged joint? Well, remember, we're going to talk about the meniscus shock absorber, the articular cartilage bearing surface, and the ligaments. And the two main ways that we treat these tissues are for the articular cartilage, we do something called a stem cell paste graft. That means we take a little bit of your own bone and cartilage, which has your stem cells in it. We take it out of the knee at the time of an arthroscopy. We smash it into a paste, We bloody your damaged articular cartilage, and we put the paste right back in. And it turns out that if you expose the joint to motion with that paste on top of your arthritic surface, it will form new cartilage. And we have very good data to show that. Now, we started doing this in 1991, and we have now long-term data that shows the effectiveness of that kind of technique. Additionally, if we do that and the joint is missing the meniscus cartilage, we need to combine the techniques. We need to give you back the fibrous shock absorber and graft your surface. We'll show you that. So the meniscus we talked about is the shock absorber. It's torn very frequently. Minimal healing spontaneously. Every once in a while, you'll have a cartilage tear that will heal on its own. Most of the time, they don't heal. And when you lose it, as we talked about, you increase the force across the joint, and you get pain in the joint on those rough surfaces. And so the most common request in my practice now is, hey, doc, isn't there just a shock absorber you can put back in my knee? I'll let you do my joint replacement later. I just want a little shock absorber for now. I want to continue running marathons or centuries, or I want to walk to the store without pain. Just buy me a little bit of time. Well, it turns out there is. We can take young, healthy meniscus cartilage from somebody who falls off their motorcycle and other people who die young and donate their tissues. And we take that young, healthy tissue, and we insert it into the knee and sew it into place. And that turns out to work as a good shock absorber for your knee. And so traditionally, people used to think, well, you really can't put a meniscus into an arthritic joint. You can just do that for young, healthy joints. And we think that's not true. We think if you graft that articular cartilage and get it to be smooth, then we can put the meniscus cartilage back in your knee, and you'll have the best of both worlds, a smooth surface and the shock absorber. And there's some very good data to say that works, and we'll show you that. And on the paste graft side, the articular cartilage side, that's where we take those pluripotential bone marrow cells, which are your stem cells, put them into a paste and pack them in, apply motion, and form new cartilage. So we started doing this, and our experience so far now is 215 meniscus allografts in arthritic knees and 333 paste grafts. So I think we have a lot of experience now, and we've actually looked at all of these patients and tried to study this data. And we published our data in a peer-reviewed journal looking at the long-term survival of concurrent meniscus replacement and cartilage transplantation in a 2 to 12-year follow-up study. So we look in the knee. It's an arthritic knee with no meniscus. We pull in a nice, new, shiny meniscus cartilage and get that to heal in place. And the study inclusion criteria for this study were people who'd lost their meniscus, more than 50% of it. They had grade 3 and 4 arthritis, so the worst arthritis in that portion of their joint, and they still had some range of motion of their knee up to 90 degrees. We don't do this for inflammatory arthritis. And then we brought all these patients back for clinical exams at 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 10, and 15 years. And we looked in the first 119 patients that we did, how long do these things last in arthritic knees? And it turns out that they last quite well. So out to 9.9 years, we had to remove 7 of them. 18 out of 119 patients during the course of the study went on to a joint replacement, as you might expect. And 13 of the patients we weren't able to find over this 12-year study. So we concluded that meniscus replacement can improve the symptoms, even in osteoarthritis, that we can repair these severely arthritic defects in people's knees, and that the improvements, both in survival of the implant and improved pain and function, last over this period of time. So you say, okay, what if I'm past that point? What if my joint has really degraded and there's bone on bone, I've got disease everywhere? It's past the point where you can put in a biologic shock absorber. Then what do I do? Well, then there are good options in that we can either partially replace the knee joint or fully replace it. Let me just show you what that looks like. If the joint surface is mostly just worn out on one side, and we don't, again, remember my bias. I don't want to do any more than I have to. I want to just treat the damaged part and take the least amount of risk possible. And so if you've worn out just one side, I just want to replace one side, and that's called a unichondylar joint replacement. And we now do this through a robotic technique that I'll show you. If, on the other hand, you've worn out the whole knee, then we have to put in a full knee replacement, and that replaces both the femur and the tibia with a metal and plastic surface. We now let our patients play any sport they want with these. I have patients skiing and hiking and mountain climbing. Most patients don't run because you want to try to preserve that plastic surface. So bionic solutions, artificial solutions, are very good solutions when you have no other biologic choice, in my bias. Let's just show you a little bit more about that. So this is the new robotic device. We need to get this video to play. Okay, you're going to look at it on the small screen. It's too good for you to miss. So in these robotic devices, by doing a CAT scan, you can map just the arthritic portion of the joint, all on computer before you ever go to surgery. And then through a very small incision rather than those big long incisions, you can just take away the arthritic part of the bone. You no longer need to take away ligaments or cut to the muscle or any of the things we had to do in the past because you've already mapped it by computer before you ever go to surgery. And so it shortens the surgery time to under an hour now, and it shortens the incision, and it permits you to put these things in very accurately. In the past, we used to put them in as accurately as we could, but we didn't have the computer mapping in order to improve that positioning. And I think the improved positioning makes a very big difference. So that's called a Mako robot. You'll hear more about that. Steal my computer back here. And so when you look at an x-ray, you can see that in this person who had an arthritic inner side, and we just replaced the worn-out part of their knee. And in this person who had a completely arthritic knee, the whole knee is replaced. Now, let's talk about where the future is going to be. So what I just showed you is the worn-out part where we put in a metal and plastic replacement. And I think that's a very good solution when you have no biologic option, meaning you've worn off the surfaces completely. Again, the knee feels more normal when you've just replaced that part of it. By doing it robotically, we can do it much more accurately than we ever were able to do it in the past. But at the end of the day, it's still metal and plastic. And remember my bias that I started this talk off with, that if I can do something biologically, I prefer to do it that way if I can, because I think that's better for you in the long run. So let me just show you what the future is going to look like. So in the lab, what we've now done is we've created a complete articular cartilage cap. Either this one is from a pig, or we also can do it from a young, healthy person. And what we then do is we take your own stem cells and we load those cells into this cartilage cap in a vacuum technique that we've been developing. In fact, I just came from the lab where we were just doing this. So in the future, instead of my putting on a metal cap on your knee, I hope to be putting on a complete intact cartilage cap. Now, this is different from what I described to you before with a paste graft. The paste graft is for repairing areas in the knee that are arthritic. This is a complete cartilage replacement when the joint is completely worn out. So I think that's where the future is going. We're working hard on it, and I think you'll see it in an operating room near you soon. However, in order to do complete cartilage replacement, we need to have a ubiquitous source of cartilage. And fortunately, there aren't enough young people falling off donor cycles to do that, and that's a good thing. But in order for us to be able to do this in a widespread way And in order for us to be able to get this to the third world, to the rest of the world that can't afford such expensive tissue techniques or expensive artificial techniques, we would like to use animal cartilage. And we'd like to use animal cartilage from pigs because, number one, pigs are very close to us genetically. Number two, everybody eats them already, and so the joints are currently being thrown away. And so it's a replacement part that we can develop without, I think, causing harm. But what's the biggest barrier to using animal tissues? And that's called immunology, meaning if I take an animal tissue and put it inside a person, it's going to be rejected. And so we spent the last 15 years working on a technique for stripping the antigens from that animal tissue to humanize the tissue. And we've now done that. We've done that for the first sequence of ligaments, and I'll show you that. It's called an antigen stripping technique. And here's a little proof of that principle. Eventually, what we'll do is do it for cartilage. So we like animal cartilage because it's unlimited supply. We like intact cartilage because I don't have to grow it. It's functional on day one. You can walk on it. And the morphology is very similar to humans. Again, the xenograft research that we started in 1995, we've now published a series of papers in the Journal of Transplantation documenting our methodology for humanizing these tissues. And this application will apply to not just cartilage, but also to bone and meniscus and heart valves and a host of other things. The big problem that we had to solve is that animals have a specific carbohydrate called a galactosyl carbohydrate, and we had to strip that specific carbohydrate in order to make it transferable to people. And so if you don't do that, you get an enormous immunologic reaction to the animal tissue, and it rejects it. The only way pig heart valves currently work for people is they fill them up with glutaraldehyde, a fixative, and put it in the chest, and it works as a fixed organ. But a fixed organ wouldn't work in your knee joint. It has to mold biologically. We need cells to grow into it. We need it to be a living organism once we transplant it. So you can't fix it the way you can in a heart valve. And so since I can't fix it to block the immunologic rejection, I've got to strip the antigens so that the body sees it as self. And so the way we do that is we take an enzymatic cleavage technique, we wash the tissue, we strip out all of those antigens, and then the body reloads it with cells or reload it with cells the way I just showed you, and then it starts to remodel. And so we did this for pig tissue, and that's a pig ligament on top. And here I've placed it after we did a series of primate studies. I placed it here in a patient's knee. And unfortunately, our video on the right is not running, but it shows the implantation of that ligament into a knee on a graphic. And then this patient is one of our early patients who went on to become the Canadian National Masters champion about 4 years in a row on what he calls his pig leg. So we know that this can now work, and we now have an FDA approval for a wide clinical trial to do this in the United States, and we've just started doing it outside the United States in South Africa and very shortly in Europe. So I think pig ligaments and other pig tissues will be coming to operating rooms near you soon as well. So that's the FDA trial that we have. Not started yet, but we've started the outside the U.S. trial. And then the future, the next step, as we described before, is loading these shell grafts with your own stem cells and resurfacing your joint within complete biologic tissue. And we do that, we suck the cells into the cartilage itself, and as long as we can get them to live in there and produce, then we think we can keep this cartilage alive. That's still the great unknown, because we haven't done it in animals yet, so I don't yet know if it's going to work, and we hope it will. And this is a little culture study that we did that showed that we could load stem cells into these cartilage implants. And then what we eventually would do is come in, take your arthritic surface there, bloody it, and put the shell right back on top of that damaged area in your joint. So the next question, just to end, just to be a little speculative for you for the fun of it, is, hey, you know, an athlete always asks, well, let's see, Doc, could my joint be better than it was before I injured it? Because it's not good enough for them just to have a pain-free knee. What's the chance I can jump higher or last longer or live longer or do all the things that we all want to do? So the question comes up, can a cartilage replacement, could the joint be better? Well, what's the reason for thinking that might even be possible? Is it just a silly idea or not? Well, it turns out if you look around you, there's some pretty darn big animals. If you look at an elephant, they live 70 years. They weigh 15,000 pounds, and they very rarely get joint arthritis. So what is it about their cartilage that can absorb 15,000 pounds of weight all year long times the multiple of their joint height and live to 70 years? So are there some intrinsic characteristics of certain animals' tissues that maybe we can harvest or use for the application? Not to say that we'd ever use elephant tissue in people, but just can we learn from something about their tissues? And it turns out their cartilage is thicker than our cartilage. And it turns out they have very few cells in it, but those cells that are there produce a lot of matrix. So they're kind of ramped up cells that really keep that tissue healthy. And we're trying to see if we can't do the same thing to the cells that we load into these tissue shell grafts. Can we juice them? Can we use an anabolic? Can we stimulate them to produce a lot of cartilage matrix? So the animal kingdom, as you know, has benefit of 400 million years of evolution. And I think if we study that, we may be able to extract some lessons from it that we could apply to you. And maybe thicker and more durable cartilage, loaded with your stem cells, loaded with growth factors, done as an outpatient. And maybe that's the future of biologic joint replacement. Thank you very much. It's good to talk with you.
The program's open for questions.
Dr. Stone, I had a medial meniscus removed, compliments of the U.S. Navy 53 years ago, and now I'm at a point where bone is rubbing against bone, and my knee, of course, swells, and I have intermittent pain. And one thing I'm doing for the last several months, like you mentioned, I joined a aerobics class, and I find that helped me somewhat. But I have to do something after all these years because I was told bone is rubbing against bone, and like my intern has told me, he says, what do you want for 52 years or 53 years?
So the U.S. military and all its wonderful things is a great referral source for us because years ago, the fastest, quickest thing they could do to get a soldier back was just take the tissue out, and we'll deal with it later. And so, you know, that's the classic patient we see today. And so clearly I can't give you advice about your knee without examining you and looking at your images and being very careful about what would be specific for you. But that's what we do every day, and we're happy to look at each of your joints and look at your x-rays and look at your MRIs. And based on all of those things, your history, your physical exam, your x-ray, your MRI, we can usually give you a very accurate diagnosis about what the possibilities are.
Dr. Stone, yeah. I have to say I'm thrilled to hear you advise and recommend non-replacement techniques because a lot of these presentations you'll go to by local orthopods are pushing their knee replacement programs, and you know I'm a great believer in doing it the minimally invasive way. Having said that, my knee, my meniscus is worn to the point where I don't yet need replacement, but I do need Celebrex every night. And I may never need replacement, but and I am going to get religion, go to the gym more often now. But my question is, how long? Celebrex is wonderful for me. I take 100 milligrams every night, been doing it for years, and it keeps me pain-free. Is safe to use Celebrex for indefinitely for years?
No. Use your good intuition. There's nothing that's safe to do artificially forever for many years. All of these drugs have significant risk profiles to them. So Celebrex is a very specific COX-2 inhibitor. And so some of the reasons its competitors were taken off the market, Vioxx being one of them, is that there was an increased cardiovascular risk over time because you're inhibiting one portion of the inflammatory cascade. But as you know, inflammation is one of the methods in which your body reacts to foreign invaders, to plaque, to a host of things in order to get rid of it. And so if you're shutting down one portion of your healthy body response, you're sacrificing that part for the joys of pain relief. So my overwhelming counsel to you is be sure to explore every non-pharmacologic technique to see how little you can use the drugs that you need to use in order to get by in life. And if you just use that as a general intuitive guide, you'll probably avoid some of the nasty complications that we all see. In the same way, I don't want to put anything artificial in your joint if I don't have to. I want to use evolution. Evolution's 400 million. I mean, I want evolution on my side as a physician caring for you or caring for me. So all of those body's reactions have been evolved over time to keep you alive. And if you artificially insert a chemical to block one of them, somewhere along the line, you're going to pay the price. So I can't encourage you enough to try to really explore the ways of not being on the drugs if you don't have to be. And that applies, by the way, to Lipitor and all the other drugs that I don't know anything about. Just use your intuition about those. Those systems are in place for very good reasons.
Assuming if a person does need a total knee replacement,
yep.
Is there any statistical information available how long
yep.
that may last?
Yep. So let's talk about that because I think there's lots of misinformation about it too. So right now, from the largest studies and the most, the biggest centers, artificial joint replacement has a survival curve in the 10 to 20 year range at 90 to 95%. And so it's a very good procedure when it is put in perfectly aligned. They fail early when the alignment or the positioning is off just a little bit. There's very little tolerance for being misaligned. And so as good an orthopedic surgeon as I thought I was, I put in lots of partial replacements over the years to the best of my ability with every guide available. And I can tell you some of them failed early. And when I analyze why did they fail early, almost all the time it's because the positioning wasn't perfect. And so I've shifted now to this robotic computer-navigated way of doing it because the fact is it's better than I am. It's more accurate than the surgeon's eye. And so you have to take the surgeon's ego out of it. No matter how good we all think we might be or somebody thinks they are, the fact is you can computer navigate these things now so that when you go to surgery, you have eliminated one of the biggest risk factors of joint replacement. Now, the second thing that's really important on these survival things is there is zero data, repeat, zero data to say what you do activity-wise will seriously affect the lifespan of your joint. And so what happened over the last 20 years is surgeons often told their patients, you've had this artificial joint, protect it, you want it to last for a long time. Well, that was really, in my view, the wrong advice. What we want you to do with your artificial joint is go exercise, because what protects the joint is keeping your bones strong, and they only stay strong in response to stress, and keeping your muscles strong around them because they only stay strong in response to stress. That's what protects the joint. And so your joint survivability is more likely than not to be better the more you exercise than the less you exercise. And so exactly the opposite information that we unfortunately all were given and gave and thought was right, really you need to exercise that joint. And the more you do, the more satisfaction you'll get out of it. So my patients ski and powder ski and play doubles tennis and climb mountains, and we encourage them to do more. And I can tell you there's zero data to say your wear will be increased if the joint is properly aligned.
Dr. Stone, the meniscus allograft and the stem cell paste surfacing, very interesting to me. Besides yourself, how commonly are they done? And if not, why not?
Yep. So they're not commonly done. In fact, I think we're still the only center in the universe putting meniscus cartilages in arthritic knees. And we published our data, but it's data from one center. And so there's not enough experience out there from multi-center trials to really have level one evidence in the literature, and so many surgeons will not do this procedure. It's also technically difficult. It ruins your whole day. I guarantee you. The meniscus has to go in perfectly, And in an arthritic knee, that's very hard to do. And so I might book 2 or 3 hours to put a meniscus transplant in, and if it's not perfect, I'm going to redo it right there. So now I'm 4 hours into it or 6 hours into it. And there are very few surgeons and hospital settings that can tolerate that kind of patience. And we have great data to say they don't work unless they're in there really very, very accurately. And so there are a lot of barriers to surgeons doing these techniques. There is, fortunately, insurance reimbursement. We've been very grateful that many of the insurance companies have figured out that if I put a meniscus in your knee and you don't have a joint replacement for 10 years, when you finally get your joint replacement, it's going to be the last procedure your joint has. So much better for you to have your joint replacement when you're 75 or 80 or 85 than to have it when you're 60. Because then they know they're going to have to do a revision later on. So it's more cost-effective for them to actually reimburse for a cartilage biologic procedure than for an artificial one. But this is just slowly getting out there, and I wish I could tell you it's widespread. It's not. But it will be. It's just it's going to take time. It's going to take more studies and time. Same with pace. Pace graft is interesting. There are other ways of doing cartilage replacements, and you'll hear about them. Genzyme, OATS, mosaicplasties, ACIs, Carticel. These are all other techniques for doing cartilage grafting that surgeons have developed over the years. The same way I've been passionate about trying to rego cartilage, there are a lot of other surgeons who are also very passionate about doing it too. And so surgeons will have their bias about which technique works the best in their hands, and I'm biased because this has worked so well in our hands, but another surgeon will have a bias about another technique that works well in their hands. However, I'll warn you, none of the cartilage replacement techniques are currently indicated for arthritis. Except pace graft. They are indicated for isolated chondral defects. So most of the time, if you go to your doc and you have arthritis, the doc will say your joints are arthritic. That's not proper for cartilage replacement because the techniques that they're using are mostly for young, healthy knees that have knocked off a piece of articular cartilage. So again, this whole field of stem cell cartilage growing is in its infancy. And it's growing. It's a bad pun, I guess, and it's going to grow rapidly, but it's really not quite there yet, which is why I labeled it the future on there. And yes, we're doing these techniques, but no, they're not widely spread yet. They will be, though.
Doctor, my question is a follow-up to that one. In listening to you, it looks like or sounds like that these the pasting technologies, the stem cell technologies, are leading-edge technologies that are elective surgery or elective procedures. Given your professional experience, when do you think that these techniques will come to an HMO near us?
No comment. I have no idea because the motivations and the reimbursement issues, they're all so backwards in the HMO world. And so probably the right answer to that question is when we and others published economic studies that show the cost effectiveness of doing an outpatient biologic procedure versus an artificial procedure. The problem is, like the military gentleman said over here, it's cheaper for them to just take it out and say, we'll see you in 10 years when you have your knee replaced. So it's a tough thing for us to fight against to say, hey, look, it's more cost effective to rebuild it biologically now and save that person from doing that and also keep them running and working and doing all the things they love to do. But it's really a challenge to figure out how you prove that in an economic world where an HMO will say, our surgeon can take that thing out in 30 minutes and next. Well, pretty tough challenge. And so I think you're going to see that in a lot of stem cell therapies, by the way, not just for arthritis that I'm so passionate about. You're going to see that in other stem cell therapies too where it looks like there's a way to treat a disease. Might be pretty expensive, might be a little unknown, and how you balance that off against the currently available techniques that are pretty good. And I just don't live in the pretty good world. My patients want to play elite-level sports. They want to run marathons. They want to be great. And so it's a little different world that I get to live in.
Couple of quick questions. Yeah? Why drink a couple of glasses of water before eating, because I would be too full to eat.
Yes, only if you want to optimize your weight. If you want to lower your weight, if you're overweight and you're trying to lose weight, the easiest way is not a fancy diet that's hard to maintain when you're on the road and other places. The easiest way is to load up on water and only water as your beverage, not any other beverage.
And it also lubricates the joints, I suppose.
Yep.
I've heard that just glucosamine is fine, and then I hear you should also have chondroitin, and which one has shellfish, and is there a... I'm vegetarian. Yep. Is there something vegetarian?
Yes. So glucosamine for joint use is from a vegetarian source, corn, and chondroitin as well. So there are definitely versions that are vegetarian-based. The issue that you probably also want to ask about is, okay, which of all the supplements matters the most? And why'd you pick glucosamine and then chondroitin here? And it's really for cost effectiveness. Glucosamine had the best data, the best studies, at the lowest cost, the lowest, you know, highest risk profile. I mean, there are no side effects to too much glucosamine. Other things that I'm sure you've all heard about, too, that are probably helpful, MSM, chondroitin is helpful. There will be a new oral hyaluronic acid to try that might be helpful. Vitamin C for sure is helpful as an antioxidant there. So what I try to encourage my patients to do is to be cost-effective. There's only so many things you can take. You want to make your pennies go as long as they can and with the highest safety profile. So glucosamine is cheap and effective, and there's no side effects. No sugar. Yeah, it's sugar-free. Chondroitin is not from shellfish. Nope. No, it can be, but it's not here. Yeah, not in this case.
Hi. Two quick questions. Why was walking not included in your list of exercises, which is...
It's an and it's my fault. So walking is a great exercise, and especially if when you walk into the building and there's an elevator and stairs, if you can just take the stairs every day,
right.
It's the easiest way for you to increase your cardiac output and your resistance exercise.
So it should have been on the list.
It should have been in there, and my
right.
fault.
Good, because I do it.
That's
and
great.
The second quick question is, how do you become part of your clinical trials?
Oh. Well, there's a host of inclusion criteria. You know, we go through an IRB, which is a study section, to make sure that our studies meet all of the appropriate inclusion requirements for someone. So the best thing, you know, we see you as a patient, and if it's appropriate, we're happy to talk with you about all of these issues, which is what I spend my life doing. Yeah. By the way, there's all of this information is on the website stoneclinic.com. There's tons of it. The exercises we like, nutrition, how you think about what hurts, self-diagnosis, all of our research data, references to other research data. We're not biased. Of course we're biased, but we're inclusive in that we realize there's lots of other approaches towards these things too. Videos from patient experiences about what worked for them, what didn't work for them. All of that. So we try to put it all in there so you have a wide range of information to look at and think about.
Dr. Stone.
Yeah.
52-year-old male, 3 knee surgeries on my right knee. First was railroad tracks before they could do it arthroscopically, and 2 arthroscopes. Since then, not much cartilage left on the medial side.
Yep.
I want to get back to being able to play singles tennis, long-distance biking, and downhill skiing.
Yep. Yeah. That's a very common request for me.
So what's the backlog to get in to see you?
I don't know. That part I stay out of, but call and they'll tell you. But so that just so you understand the thinking, that's a super common, maybe the most common patient that I'm seeing right now. And the thought process that we need to go through together is, okay, your goals are very clear and they're totally reasonable in my view. I want you doing all 3 of those things until you're 105 and you drop on the ski slope. So that's our goal. So what do we need to do to keep you able to progress along that pathway? We'll use artificial things when we need to, but can I keep you doing impact stuff on biologic tissues for now? And so that's the thought process. What the difference from today versus what you went through before is now we're putting things in versus taking things out. So almost all of orthopedic surgery has been about taking biologic tissues out. You know, we're taking out your torn cartilage, you're taking out your damage, we're doing a cleanup of the knee, a very common term, right? So most of my life now is putting those things back in one way or the other with cells or with intact tissues or some version of that. And if that's good enough, and often I don't have to get your knee pain-free, I just got to get your knee down to so you can play on it, then we can do those things. And if you're already destroyed it, then how do I put an artificial component in dead on straight so that you can play on it and not really worry, knowing it's going to fail, they'll all fail eventually, but hopefully that it fails late enough that you've really enjoyed your next couple of decades. We think every decade's precious. We don't know how many of them we get, and we want to play hard during every one of them, and so that's the way we think about it.
Quick follow-up. I'm now getting pain in my left knee. Never had any surgeries or any traumas to it. Is there, because of being favored over the years, and is there anything that can be done about that?
Super common question, and usually it's because of favoring. Remember, as I said, any patient who's had an arthritic joint for any period of time has developed an abnormal gait. It's like a car that's out of line. You're going to wear the tire pattern abnormally, and you don't just wear one tire. You wear the other tire, too. So as you're favoring your injured knee, you're placing abnormal torque on your normal knee. And I want you to stop doing that as soon as possible. I don't want to operate on your normal knee. I don't want to operate on either knee if I don't have to. But it's a shame to damage your uninjured knee out of just bad gait pattern. And we think we can overcome that with usually good exercise, good therapy, good motion, gait training, balance training, all the things that we think are important. I think that guy, I think you have to have a microphone for the audience.
A very practical question. Excuse me. I actually canceled an appointment tomorrow morning at 11:30 only for practical reasons. Having come here today, there isn't any question I would like your service. I am a Medicare patient with a Medicare supplement private supplement policy. My understanding is your program is not appreciated by Medicare from your point of view. So my question is, before I come see you, is there some broad brush, stage by stage, cost generalizations that I would be putting out to make a cost-benefit analysis? There isn't any question if there were no cost where the benefit is.
Right.
I would be in your hands. But there has to be that practical consideration under my consideration. Is that an appropriate question at this point?
Yeah, it's a dilemma that I don't know how to answer. It's like the HMO question over here. Healthcare systems, for very good reasons, have got to figure out how to be cost-effective to treat the major number of people. And so I don't criticize Medicare at all. It's a fantastic program. But there's no way that Medicare can accommodate for a host of the new things that are occurring. And so, of course, I see lots of Medicare patients, but they have to choose to go outside of Medicare to do it because we can't accept assignment or we're not allowed to do the, you know, there are too many rules that prevent us from doing what we're trying to do. So I have to live on the side of trying to push the envelope forward. And in order to do that, I can't live on the side of restrictions of the HMO world, which is also Medicare. Not that I don't think they're fantastic programs. They are. To answer your question, I can't answer because there's just so many variables about which treatment would be cost-effective for you, and there's no way to know. I hate giving bad advice, and so I don't want to give any advice unless I've got all the data. I've got the exam in my hands, what your joint feels like. I can look at your gait. I can look at your x-rays. I can look at your MRI, which Medicare probably wouldn't approve. You know, I want all that data so I can give you really good advice. I hate giving bad advice. Yeah, I can tell you exactly what I would suggest you do. I can't ever make you a promise it'll work, but I can tell you what I would do for my knee in that setting. Yeah, of course.
If someone has had part of their meniscus removed but doesn't yet have any arthritic pain, at what point in the timeline should they be thinking about having some biologic repair done?
Yeah, it's a really great question. If you're a child or a teenager and if you have enough of the meniscus removed, you will destroy your joint, especially the lateral meniscus. And so I think prophylactic meniscus replacement in kids is really important. I just did one today. As an adult, if you've had surgery in the past but you're asymptomatic, you're doing everything, you're not having symptoms, you're doing everything you want to do, you know in your mind it might be gone, I really recommend you stay on exercise and good supplements and maintain your weight and come talk to me when you have knee pain. It's not too late. And it brings up one other point. I wish I could make you a promise that if I put in your cartilage or a new meniscus, it would work. And the problem is there's so much biologic variation in everybody sitting here in this audience that I can't tell you that. I can tell you what I would do for my knee in that setting, and I can do my very best to put that in. And as soon as I do that, I'm then watching you like a hawk because I'm going to learn from you and every patient that I do what your biologic variation is to those tissues going in. It's not a metal and plastic piece that we know how it's going to work for sure. And so my patient has to partner with me in this deal, and then I'll give you my best surgery, but you have to give me your best effort at the rehab, and you have to realize that I'm going to study you every year. The only way I got that data out over 15 years is because I make a contract with the patient that you're going to come back and let me do x-rays and MRI, which Medicare wouldn't approve, of course, and all the things that I need to do to figure out what's going to happen, what does happen to your joint over the course of as many years as I'm alive, you're alive, to these biologic structures that we're trying to rebuild. And it's a very different contract between us. And that contract does not fit into any normal HMO program. Fortunately, most insurance companies do reimburse for a lot of what we do, sometimes completely, sometimes not at all. You know, you have to figure out what your insurance company is, and our folks in our office help you do that and try to figure it all out with you. But it's a tough nut. So the short answer to your question is don't do it if you're not having symptoms, in my view. I wouldn't take the risk in my own knee as an adult until I knew I needed to do it, because it's a risk. Somebody with a microphone. Yeah.
Hi. I have two off-the-wall questions about the knee issue.
Yeah.
Both stemming from personal. My mom had knee surgery due to a car accident, and she's had injections for some sort of issue to put some cushion or something into the knee for some arthritic thing. She still gets knee pain. And when she's surprisingly constipated, and it's not something you discuss in the U.S. a lot, but you discuss in Europe and Asia, but when she's not constipated, her knee pain's gone. Do you have any correlation with that for the work you've done in terms of the acidity and how that affects the knee and the pressure?
Nope.
Okay. It's not a topic discussed here. See, people don't discuss digestive issues and health as a whole. But second question I had is that I spent a long time living in Europe, and are you also offering these services in Europe to clients and patients in Europe too, or not?
Not normally. I'm in Switzerland next week teaching surgeons how to do these things, but I don't operate there normally. I'd love to call on anybody, but you have to have a microphone, so grab the guy in the middle there, and that's kind of the way to get it.
I'm wondering if you are able to help elderly, that is people in their 90s, who are being told by the orthopedist that they're too elderly for replacement surgery, but they're having difficulty getting around. And also, are you thinking at all of working on shoulders?
Yes, I'm sorry. I do shoulder, knee, and ankle. The knee cartilage replacement techniques are the most advanced, with ankle being second and shoulder last. They're not zero. They're just not as advanced as they are in the knee. And in terms of the elderly, I think the way that we help our elderly patients the most is in all the stage one stuff that I talked about before. It's rarely surgical. It's so many people have unfortunately gotten into that trap of no activity as they've aged. Yeah. And so if we can get them active, then the surgical techniques are available to people of any age. Remember, my goal is to have them go when they're being active. And so if there's something that's holding them back that I can fix, I'm thrilled to be able to try. And
Hi. You did not talk about the patella, and I happen to have two unstable knees because my patella is half the size that it's supposed to be.
Yeah, so I treat a lot of ballet dancers. I cover the Smoon Ballet and a number of other companies, and probably one of the more common things we see in those dancers is hypermobility of the patella, and sometimes they dislocate their kneecaps. And so what's changed over the last 10 to 15 years in our practice is we've been able to identify the specific ligament that controls the patellar motion and rebuild that ligament. In the past, we used to move bones around and change muscles and do a host of things. And so if proprioception, muscle training, gait training don't work well enough, then, and if the ligament is torn and the kneecap's unstable, you can rebuild that ligament to stabilize the kneecap. Now, there's a host of other things to think about, though. If the kneecap's arthritic, if the bone, the femur itself is not properly formed, which sometimes happens, there's a long laundry list there of things I have to go through to figure out what the right solution is for that particular knee.
Yeah, ligaments are intact, but no cartilage left on my patella.
Yeah, so The kneecap, the patella, is the toughest of all the things to regrow cartilage on because the poor blood supply and extremely sensitive to anything you do with it. And so sometimes now we'll do a partial knee replacement just for the patella and trochlea. And that also is relatively new. We weren't able to do that very accurately in the past. And again, that Mako robot permits us to just replace the part that's worn out now rather than have to replace the whole knee. So that's one of the things that's changed. There's a host of other little things we can talk about depending on what on your particular knee. So,
I have the mic right now.
Yeah.
My question is about Synvisc.
Yep.
You spoke earlier about Celebrex, and I experienced some real disadvantages with that. What about Synvisc? Can one continue to use that over time? I've had a series of Synvisc, sometimes 2 years apart, then 18 months apart. Then a third time, it just only lasted a couple of weeks. So do you develop a resistance to it, or is that just sort of circumstances?
So Synvisc is hyaluronic acid, the lubricant that we put in people's knees now. And there actually are about four different versions of that lubricant. And Synvisc is the most popular, most well-known one, but it's also the one that has the highest joint reactions. And so, in general, we try to avoid using that specific formulation. We use the other ones if we can. We don't know anything about resistance over time yet because this hadn't been around long enough. We don't think there's any toxicity to injecting them, and so we usually use it for patients every 6 months if that's useful for them. And in patients who do respond, they get tremendous relief. So it's really safe. And the other thing to know is we used to do them as a series of injections, three or five injections over time. We now do them all at once because the data is that if you take all three of those injections and put them together and put it in, it works just as well. So we now do a single injection, no longer a series of injections, and I'm very uninhibited about doing those. I think they're very safe and really nice tool to help people. We happen to use Suparts, but there's several of them, Effluxa, Suparts, Heilgan. They're all a little bit different than Synvisc. I've used a lot of Synvisc as well, but it's the one that produces joint irritation. And so if you got a little bit resistant to it, I would switch to the other one.
I have two quick questions. The first is, am I correct in understanding that this might be an option if I've had trauma to the knee and I have that my ortho called dashboard knee?
Yeah.
This might be an option?
Yes.
Okay, and then also about if you have to go ahead and go through knee replacement, and there was something in the paper a while ago about make sure that there was a difference between male and female, that all the research had been done on men, and so I don't know much more about that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So one company promoted gender-specific knees thinking that there was a big difference, and it turned out it was much more fit than it was gender. And so the most important thing is that whichever device the surgeon's using is that they get it to fit your knee and go in dead on straight than any other factor. So in general, the gender stuff is trailing away was kind of a cool marketing tool for one company, but the data didn't really hold up. It was mostly fit.
Knee pain. What is the mechanism? What actually causes knee pain, especially with osteoarthritis?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there's lots of causes. The first thing in osteoarthritis, remember those rough surfaces, they splay little bits of cartilage around the joint. The lining of the joint, the synovium, gets irritated, causes swelling, causes pain, even without the swelling, sometimes just causes pain. The second thing is that when you've lost the cartilage, now it's bone on bone or thin cartilage on thin cartilage, and that's more sensitive to the bone, and that's another pain generator. The bone's actually sensitive in that area. Third, the meniscus is very innervated. And so when you tear that meniscus or if you have a rough surface on the articular cartilage bearing on the meniscus, that will generate pain through the meniscus tissue itself. So any one of those things can be pain generators.
All right. I'm afraid we're going to have to call an end to this. It's been very fascinating. I'd like to thank Dr. Kevin Stone for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 108th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Excellent.